So here I am in a bus out the back of the Avalon Rising Arena at the Green Gathering, where we've got quite a number of people who've been helping us put up tents and get food together, and we're now preparing. The place is open, the public's pouring through the gates, and we're getting ready to do 3 days of informing people and entertaining them. And one of the first people that's come along to chat with me this evening, we've spoken with before on the radio show, is John Bide, who's doing all manner of interesting research of his own into what happens to metal alloys when you put them in stream water, as well as working on the work of Victor Schauberger. And he's here to talk with me, so thanks a lot for coming along, John. What are you here to talk about this time?
Well, thanks for the intro. Really to do with water, which I started researching about 10 years ago. And I was running my own experiments outside my house because I was reading about vortexes and hyperbolics and the shape of the water as it goes down your plug hole, so I built my own. And I was running a whole bunch of experiments out the back of the house. And at one stage, I had water injected into the top of this bottle. It was a 2-litre Coke bottle. And there were brass injectors, I called them, but I cobbled them all together just to get the water spinning nice and evenly. And I wanted to short them all out, that I electrically, and I thought, well, I'll use a strip of brass to do that, and I put that in the top of the vortex. And I forgot about it. I did my measurements, which were non-conclusive, so I was a bit disappointed I didn't get a result, because I was expecting to find 25,000 volts, you know, somewhere. And I had electric meter, you know, electric meter, and I was dangling it around, all inconclusive. Didn't really know what I was doing, but I'd forgotten about the brass strip. When I went there next day or the day or so later, I don't know how long it was, there was a pattern on the brass from the water. Well, it was from the water. And when he unrolled it, where the injectors were, it looked like a string of sand dunes. You know, it looked like a landscape. And I was just amazed at this. And from that, I decided, well, it's funny how it works out, because I was looking for measuring instruments. I wanted to measure flows. So I was using inks in the putting it in the water, and I was seeing different geometry than is shown with particles. Because mainly people measure the shape in the vortex with coffee grounds or shit like that. And I was using food dyes with a refill, I don't know what you call it, hypodermic type thing that you use for refilling ink cartridges. And I was injecting ink in the bottom and in the top. And I was thinking, I've never seen anything like this. Because at one stage you injected the water at the bottom and the ink column goes upstream. And I thought, I'm looking for levitational effects. What's that? If it's not levitation, but have a look at that.
So effectively, you're taking what we know to happen as water travels down a plug hole, and you're taking it outside your house and making it visible. You've made yourself a device to make like the vortex as water runs out of a bath. And then you've been putting ink in the top of it, and it's been rising up the middle.
Well, yeah, I did put it in the top, and you can see things. You can see how it spirals down the middle, which is very fast. You have one drip and it kind of disappears. But I don't know why I did it, but I put the ink where the water flows out.
Okay, so effectively there's some sort of energy running in the opposite direction from the downward flow.
Yeah, now that is interesting, isn't it? I was remembering all Schauberger's experiments and then looking at high fish in high mountain streams, especially, well, mainly trout. And that when you frighten a trout in a high mountain stream, it goes upstream. See, that really to me is counterintuitive, because the weight of the water and the weight of the fish, the trout should go downstream. But in this case, upstream. On nearly every occasion you ever see a trout, will go upstream. So it must be. And the other thing is, when you see it in the high mountain stream, it's sort of sitting there with its mouth open and its occasional flick of the tail. And that water is rushing by, you know, at fast walking speed. How's it staying there? So
just sort of hanging in the water with minimal movements from its body. So how is it hanging there?
That's right. I mean, there are other advantages to this for the fish, because the main food stream spiraling down this, it does turn out to be a longitudinal spiral in the water. Or you might say it is a similar shape to the way the water drains out your plug hole, but obviously it's in a river. So it's got longitudinal spirals, but it's also got transverse as well, because you have laminar flows in a river. So you have different temperature gradients top to bottom, and each one of those acts like a river within the river, so it creates its own turbulence. And this turbulence actually slows the water down. It's like a braking force, but in the middle is a faster flowing flow. All of these things become a bit more apparent if you read the eco-technology series. So I won't go into all the facts and figures. It's just down the interesting stuff. So it was really after reading the books I was looking for. It was in the back of my mind. The intention was to find some way of measuring or seeing this levitational force, because actually Gurdjieff mentions in well, it's not Gurdjieff. He's quoted in Search of the Miraculous by Ospensky that we are third force blind. And I was thinking, well, this is interesting as well. I'm sort of mapping information here. You probably know what I mean by that, Nick. So that's in the back of my mind. Well, third force blind. You mean there's gravity, or there's an object travelling and it meets a resistance, bang. So the resistance makes heat, makes sound. But what Gurdjieff's talking about is actually a neutralising force. He refers to it as a neutralising force, which may vary under the circumstances. So if you've got a third force you can look at, if it's called a force or a resultant in water, then that's, I would say, would probably be, you know, could be the levitational force.
And you were saying that you were saying earlier on that trout could jump kind of 100 feet up a waterfall using this sort of onboard technology.
Well, that is interesting. Actually, I wouldn't use the word jump. You've got to talk You've got to talk about levitational forces, because Schauberger being there, he was Austrian, and so he was a hunter, and he was also a well, he was a forester. He'd been in the family for generations. He didn't have a conventional education, which was a big advantage to him. So he had no conditioning in his mind. He just said comprehend and copy nature, which he did. So the fish, when it was sitting on station, he was just thinking, well, that's very interesting. It goes upstream when you scare it, and downstream half a mile is a waterfall, which is 100 feet high. And these fish go up and down the river to the spawning grounds, you know, at least once a year. I don't know how often they do it, but they definitely have got upstream, so it's no jump. I mean, if you're going for the acceleration and popping out the water at 6 feet, 10 feet, we've seen the bears catching the fish, you know, that are hopping out up little runnels or little waterfalls, but they're not clearing more than, I suppose, max 20 feet, and max height 4 or 5, maybe 6 feet. And that's a powerful fish. So if you've got 100 feet, there's no way it's jumping up the waterfall.
Fair point.
It can't be doing that. It must be using another method. And that's where it gets very interesting, because what Schauberger is saying is when you have a high mountain stream that is running what he called, he used a special word, he did have to invent terms. He called it naturalesque flow of energy. When we come across a river and we think, oh, it's flooding, we've got to straighten it out, you destroy these subtle energy effects. And if you ever watch your water going down your shower curtain or the condensation on a window, it never goes straight down. Not unless it's following a previous path. It'll always do a little wiggly dance. You know, it's always wiggling. That's what a river does over thousands of years up its floodplain. So what it's showing you is the way, you might say the most efficient way to move a fluid is not a straight line.
Do you lose, if you're moving it in a straight line, do you lose those separate kind of layers of temperature and stuff you were talking about?
You can still get some laminar flows, but you lose the subtle energy. What happens is the river, as it does, it's a dance. It'll do a anti-clockwise spin going round a bend to the right. It'll do a clockwise spin or the other way around, going round to the left. They're probably round the other way around. It'll do several of those, and it'll build up energy. It'll build up a subtle energy, and it's almost like it builds up like a tension inside the flow of the water, and it releases this. And when it releases this energy, I forget what Schauberger called that, but he did call it a particular name. But where it releases that energy, that shoots into the land each side, and it'll form a ford. It'll dump its sediment at that point, or its rocks, and then it'll start winding up again, and it'll make another point. He could call that point the zero point. And in his subsequent experiments, he had funny-shaped pipes based on what's called the kudu horn, which is an African antelope. But that shape seems ideal for generating or representing in a tube, if you like. It's like a river in a tube. And then you could measure various effects on that. There's a lot of information and disinformation, because this stuff really leads to all kinds of interesting effects, such as meterless energy production. And it's on the cold running side, that's implosive side, which is the female energy, which is like suction. So all these shapes I'm mentioning to do with the hyperbolic, and also the phi spiral come into it. So you can see all the same shapes in the ripples in the water as it goes down the plug hole. You'll see the phi spiral, you see it in galaxies, you'll see it in the von Karman vortex street, so-called, in any turbulence, all these sort of flows. is that nature uses, well, these shapes are naturally come about because of the implosive effect, and they are up to 100 times stronger, so Schauberger says, than the masculine hot energies. We've got internal combustion engines, hot, everything's hot, hot nuclear, and nature's doing it on the cold side, and she's using electricity, not nuclear. So,
what sort of stuff did Schauberger do to investigate these ideas?
Well, it was, there was basically there was various things he discovered, you might say, serendipitously. So there's one, there's several stories from the books. There's four books called the Ecotechnology series, and they were published by Gateway, Alex Bartholomew, many years ago, and they were the translations of Schauberger's notes and his family's notes about his work, and they were translated by Callum Coates, who's still around, but he did a brilliant job. So there's like a transition from him, you know, as a boy growing up in the woods, and he'd go off on adventures. He said odd things, actually. It was a bit shamanic. He said, you've got to think from the octave above. And I've heard that reference before with people like Tesla and even Keeley talking this way, whatever that might mean. But the other thing he said, he had a facility of mind where he allowed his consciousness to actually go with the water. And when it came back, it had a bunch of information. And what he did is turn it into actual mechanisms, working machines. One of them's called, one of the most well-known is his home generator plant, which was a later development. One of the earlier, well, around the Second World War would be what's called the Repulsin, so the Repulsin and Repulsator series. It does get a bit obfuscated, but it links in, for example, I mean, just to say, is that when Austria was annexed by Germany, he had a three-hour interview with Adolf Hitler in person. When he came out of there, Hitler said to his money man, I can't remember who that was, give this man whatever he requires to build the stuff he needs to build. And he did build very extensive, I don't know where they were done, in the mountains of Wenceslas Mine or various places. There's links, you might say, to Peenemünde, but Peenemünde was really the hot energies. They're the V1, V2, I call them the repulsive rockets. That was, what was he called? Von Braun. So, you know, deals were done at the end of the Second World War, but basically the Nazis never surrendered. It was only the German people and the German army. The Nazis never surrendered. So basically the Nazis emptied the box called physics, and they put anything in that which appeared to work. So if it was Vimanas from India or monks that meditated in the Himalayas and levitated, they were in. There's also, they developed a kind of an occult society called the Vril, which led to the development, so we believe, because in the Vril Society there were two girls, I've forgotten the names offhand, but they had long hair, and they downloaded schematics and also writing in a very strange hand. I don't know if you call it download, however you want to view that, however that was working, but they also had an engineer on board, and I can't remember the others in the group. But basically they were coming up with a possible way of floating about, let's call it that. I call them levity bubbles. Some people like Keshe do not like the term anti-gravity. I mentioned Keshe because he's in Iran now, and he released to the world all his studies. He was there. We're jumping about a bit here, I'm so apologise.
I was wondering, we were talking earlier on about this idea of lift being created by positive and negative charge on wings, and I was talking to Nolan earlier on about the fact that they might be doing that with aircraft now, enabling them to do just what you're describing. To effectively hover and move around, you know, unlike in other aeroplanes. I mean, have we seen any technology that's working like this?
Well, not mainstream. There's a guy called, if you go to Project Camelot and have a look at Project Blue Book, there's a guy called Michael Schratt there, and he's looked at all the prototypes, all the early, early and later planes, and different ways of staying up in the atmosphere, you might say. But conventional planes are working with the Coander effect. Basically, that means as you accelerate a fluid, you decrease pressure. And so if you've got a curve on the top, that air is traveling further and faster. So it creates a negative, call it a semi-vacuum, and the wing rises up into that, drawing the plane with it. And you have a kind of positive pressure underneath. What you were talking about is a much more interesting technology, which was to charge the leading edge of the wing differently to the exhaust. And this did two things. One is it generated a little bit of extra thrust, but the other thing it did was it reduced, it reduced fuel consumption 60%. So in a way it sounds like it's making the wing more slippery, But there was also gravitational anomalous effects to do with these processes, which they were also studying. But a lot of it would be based on the work that Schauberger did. Or the way I think about it, in the Second World War, it was an ideal place to do lots of things. But if you need technology or you need brains, then start a war and annex countries, because then you suck out all the best brains and you tell them that's where they're going to work and they're going to do this. I just want to finish this one point, really. The point I wanted to make is basically von Braun gave us the hot rockets, and that was the watch the birdie, while we piss off to Brazil, Argentina and an Antarctica in craft which use different effects.
Yeah. So we're talking there about a concept we never really did quite understand, as far as I see it, how aeroplanes stay in the air anyway. The whole aerodynamics and turbulent flow thing has sort of somewhat evaded us. But it appears that there are the forces involved there, we're saying, to do with electricity, but also to do with gravitationally anomalous, which presumably means that you're getting lift where you might not expect to get any. So that's an interesting thing in itself, isn't it? That there's this whole invisible world that's kind of easing the invention, presumably, of new craft. But I'd like to just return to the subject of the fish and how they get up those large waterfalls, because that's, again, a kind of lift that we wouldn't expect to find, isn't it?
Well, it's a different kind of floating, rather than having a swim bladder and a difference in density. But you might say the same applies, kind of as above, as below. Depends what you're floating up. And one of the things that all physics kind of denies is ether and how that might work. A-E-T-H-E-R.
Yeah.
And how it's very hard to measure. And because they deny this, they talk about frame dragging, they talk about all kinds of things. This is in the spatial terms to do with planets and things like celestial objects. But I think the same applies down here to a certain degree. I can't say I've fully understood it, and I haven't seen this effect, but it's described in the books that in a high mountain stream that's running in this natural-esque way, where all the energies are balanced, it's in really good nick, might be quite low temperature waters, but the fish actually at the base of the waterfall does a peculiar dance. It's like a lemniscate. A lemniscate is like a figure of eight on its side, so it's dancing in this way, the way water moves. And for some reason, it seems to open a gate or in the energies, and it floats upstream. It does not jump. Might give a little skip at the end to get over the edge, but it's floating. There's no way it can get up 100 feet. There must be other forces at work than just, a fish swimming like heck in the bottom of the pool.
Are we talking partially your third force, our Gurdjieff's third force, the neutralizing one?
Yeah, this is something that's worth experience or exploring, is we talk about action and reaction, but we hardly ever talk about resultants or neutralizing forces, which are really above the whatever's going on at the obvious physical level, because all of our senses are really designed to see, touch, feel, smell. But it kind of leads on to my other talk, that it's, if you open the pineal or you see things in another way, basically you cannot see what you're not the vibration of. It doesn't mean to say there are not other phenomena, it's just you are not open to them. Another way of looking at it that I think about is, if something did not exist for somebody, they would not bother naming it. So where does the Avalon, where does Brigadoon, where does Camelot, where does Atlantis ideas come from that people still see them?
Yeah.
The other interesting thing about this, Einstein may be right, E=mc². So as you approach the speed of light, your mass becomes infinite. But is there anything about us which has no mass? Like, what is the mass of thought?
That's a very good question, isn't it? A whole load of our system is actually massless.
Exactly, and also the conceptual side of the mind, where you go when you're daydreaming. Does it have any mass? So you're out of time. There is no time. You have no mass.
Yeah.
There's no inertia. All you have are these ideas, and those are the ones I think that from that sort of place, will release us from our bondage and on the surface of the earth. I don't know if this is answering all the questions, but just another little thing about the you could call it technology to do with the trout as it shoots upstream. In fact, its gills are going faster than its tail, and what it's doing is popping what are called solitons, which are very like smoke rings. So it opens its mouth and then closes its mouth and pops open its gills, and these water rings roll down its flanks, as they're doing that, they expand and squeeze the fish forward on these frictionless bearings. There's also a gaseous exchange to do with the metabolism of the fish, which causes the gases in the expelled air to also expand. So it's being squeezed and it's rolling. That's why it goes so darn quick. And that's why it tapers towards the end. So your most efficient shape through the water is probably an elongated egg shape. And actually, Schauberger later developed this. He called it the biotechnical submarine, which you can also look up online. There's a lot of pictures about this. And it's a beautifully designed piece of kit. It's very unconventional. And it's probably silent running. I mean, some people think that the Russians or others have developed this for underwater craft. And they call it the tractor drive, as in the Hunt for Red October. Yeah. What's that noise? We've never heard anything like that before. We can almost not hear anything. How is it moving? It must be their tractor drive. Anyway.
One of the things that Schauberger investigated pretty thoroughly was the spinning of water, wasn't it? Which effectively brings it back to life. Even quite badly damaged rivers could, by being made to spin, be rejuvenated, as far as I gather. And I know you mentioned Noel earlier on in connection with a vast project to do with spinning water. Do you want to introduce him and his project and see what he's got to say? Because you mentioned it in passing, Noel, and I'm very interested to hear what it is and what it does.
Yeah, well, I've done probably met Noel on Schauberger groups, Yahoo groups, many years ago. And well, he's an engineer, really, or is that what dig holes and put things in, but a little more sophisticated than that. We're talking buildings here. So he knows his stuff and he knows how to set out buildings. So, he told me he'd built this pipe, which seems a bit unusual. And this pipe, because I'm interested in spinny water and pipe, and he's got spinny water down a rather long pipe, which is 84 meters. And maybe he'll tell us something about it. Also, he learnt about kinesiology en route, and he uses those inquiries to find out various things like the spin rate of the water and what she's doing. We exchange views. I mean, he did all the work. I chipped in a few ideas. And anyway, it's been an amazing journey. So here's Noel.
Hi, I'm a bit new to all this. I usually keep myself to myself. I guess I don't know what the protocols are. Perhaps Nick will ask me a question and I'll answer it. I don't know.
I mean, one of the things that John was mentioning was that you have a very large tube, the largest one he knows of, specifically to spin water down. What's that in aid of? Is it part of a plant or is it a sort of a thing that's a standalone thing?
It's a long story, but there's no shortcut to telling you it, so I'll try and be brief. I've always been open-minded about there being more than just eat, shit and die, because of experiences many years ago. And I kind of made a pact and I said, when my family's needs are met, I'll do whatever you want me to do, whoever or whatever you are. And it came to pass that my family's needs were met. The houses had been built and sold and money banked, and the kids grew up and had places to live, and then it was like, okay, what do I do now? And at this time I'd started going to visit a kinesiologist who was basically fixing up all the local chainsaw boys when they got broken, and they said he's a bit weird but it works, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And I learnt by going to be treated by this chap Ray in Chegford in Devon, I learnt a lot. Basically, it was pretty uncanny, because he just asked questions about what's wrong, and he would then say, "And how do we fix it?" And the answer would very often be, "Page 28, volume 7, treatment 5," and he'd built up all these different treatments and written them all down, and it was bloody amazing. So one day he said to me, have a look at this jug I've built. And he created this little clay pot that had a double wobble in it and a pointy bit in the bottom and a flare out at the top. And he said, look what happens when you hold the pendulum over it. And the pendulum span around really fast without touching the edge. He said, have a go. And I did. And it was totally uncanny. This pendulum was going like the clappers, round and round and round. And then when I put my hand over the jug, you could feel the energy emanating from it. And he said, this is what I've been shown how to energize water. And I said, well, how did you know what to build? And he said, well, I did it by inquiry. And he said, I just basically built a graph to plot the profile of the jug. So, you know, 10 mil up, 6 mil across. And yeah. I was like, I related to that. And at the same time, we started inquiring. It was mind-blowing. I said, hey, do you think rather than having a treatment, we could see if we could inquire about Victor Schellberger? And may we inquire? And the answer came back, yes. So I was like, whoa.
Oh, so you're using kinesiology for research, effectively. Oh, that's a yes. clever idea.
Oh, boy, it gets better. So the very first session was, can we ask? Yes. And the information we got on that very first session was that there was a requirement to heal the Earth's water. And there was information available about spinning the water. And I said, well, that's okay, right? I'll spin the water, you heal it. And then we're both on a mission. But it didn't pan out like that. But the other thing we learned by inquiry was we asked a simple question. Were these ideas Victor's ideas? Were they original ideas? And the answer was no. So where did Victor's ideas come from? By playing the yes-no game, we came back to an Abyssinian water temple that I think was 4,500 years ago. Was it 4,500 BC? I've got it written down.
Yeah.
Which was about a time when that area was going through a significant change of climate and got very dry. And they got these guys running the water temples back then, according to what we were being given. And that was where Victor was getting his ideas from. And I knew from reading about Victor that he did a lot of his work in a trance-like state. So he didn't know what the hell he was doing. He'd kind of come to in the morning and have a beautiful picture and a load of really neat ideas written down.
And he kind of is without peer, isn't he? He's kind of one of a kind. His ideas really didn't arise anywhere else.
I don't entirely agree. In regards to the spinning of the water, you're right, but he's not unique because there are lots of others like Nick Tesla who couldn't stop the ideas from coming through, and Walter Russell, who was again energized by, you know, being in that sort of mind state.
Right.
And so it was like learning to get into that mind state to tap into the same knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so we learned this. And then in subsequent sessions, we made inquiries about how to spin the water. And it was kind of given that we could build this pipe and we could just basically, it was ever so simple, just to flick the water. And as the pressure built over length, the spin rate increased.
Okay.
And then there was five little exit holes at the bottom where the water exited. There's five little entrance holes at the top to kind of like induce some spin. And then it went quickly through a corner because it was a vertical entry. And then I was like drawing all these pictures and we were making all these inquiries. And then suddenly I realized that I could do kinesiology on my own using interlocked fingers and thumbs.
Yeah.
And start asking questions. So I was doing fairly simple basic stuff like can we ask for the level of consciousness of various people, and you know, this is as a result of reading a book by David Hawkins called Power versus Force, which you may or may not have come across.
No, I'm not aware of that one.
But it was a life-changing book for me because it just kind of right.
It's a very subtle name, isn't it? Power versus Force.
Yeah, but it nails it because power is something that needs no force to exert. Force always needs more force to maintain its authority. Mm-hmm. Power does it effortlessly.
Right.
So, yeah, the good stuff is power, the bad stuff is force.
Yeah.
And I go with that. So I was learning how to build the pipe and all the details, and I was being shown how to put a little impeller on the bottom that would spin and give me a few revs and maybe generate a bit of electricity.
Okay.
And then one day we're doing an inquiry. And it transpired, and this was a real shocker at the time, it transpired that this is all just a training exercise for you. You know, you're not kind of ready for the spinny thing yet, but we want the pipe built. And so the pipe got built, and it was a long, slow process to get the water up to speed. And John came up with some magic ideas, like take the water from the bottom that's been through the pipe, put it in the top, send it round again so that you're reinforcing the message.
Yeah.
And then, like, maintain continuity right through the water came through in one inquiry. And it was a slow process building up. And then we kind of got there, and it was like, okay, so what now? We've got this water spinning in the pipe. And it was, it in fairness, the chemistry changes. You know, the Environment Agency monitor it because it's dodgy water from a mine.
Right.
And I just run it round in a little circle and send it back on its course.
Okay.
And so I'm getting analyses, and we're pulling a little bit of cadmium out, and we're dropping a bit of iron out, but that's easy to do. So yeah, we're getting some oxidation through the spinning process. But what I also learned, this is one of the most amazing things I learned, was how water loses its memory. Okay, now basically within this pipe there seems to be five kind of primary, what I call rollers. And remember, this is a 3D dynamic, so it's moving along the pipe as it spins.
Yeah.
But there's a five primary rollers if you run a cross section.
Okay.
Now, they don't touch because otherwise there'd be conflict. So wherever there could be conflict, another roller sets up in between to exactly balance the two out like a ball bearing. So you've got a set of bigger rollers, smaller rollers, and then where you've got further conflict, even smaller rollers, the Fibonacci, all the way down. Okay.
And these are like sort of separate currents of water.
Well, there's a ball rather than a rope. So a ball. Okay. And each one's spinning, and wherever there's conflict, a smaller one triggers. And the geometry's there. It can't be any other. All the way down. Okay. Now, here's the other thing about the rollers, is that the bigger one rolls slowly. The smaller one rolls quicker. The even smaller one rolls even quicker. So you're getting a gearing effect, and the very smallest of all is being spun incredibly fast. And that is how water loses its memory, the spin, pure and simple. Okay?
Yeah.
And that's what
spin is, information.
Yeah, but by spinning it fast enough, we seem to change the information. So that the water is purified. And this seems to be how the stream cleanses.
Yeah. So you are effectively cleansing the stream a little, are you? No, the
stream cleanses itself by dancing three to the right.
Yeah.
Energy cannon, three to the left. Energy cannon, in the way Schauberger describes it.
Yeah.
But that's how it cleanses, because of the roller effect, gearing it up, and you're getting within the visible spin, the less visible, down to the invisible.
Wicked.
It's fabulous. It's so simple, and it looks like that principle extends beyond water into air, and possibly even into damaged things like radioactive situations.
Right.
This is what we're kind of pondering.
So we're looking at the possibility that we might be able to clean up things quite extensively. Now that we know, and this again is kind of like a hidden force, isn't it? Or a hidden.
We're looking at Dale Pond is currently working on ways to trigger a spin,
yeah.
Which is quite interesting. But that's not an area that I'm particularly well up on. But if I could just go back onto another topic, because John triggered it, the talking about the trout. This is another amazing little journey within a journey.
Yeah.
I was shown that one of the things that makes the rotor go better than a normal water wheel would go was using the copper materials, or the three materials that enhance the rate of spin are gold, silver and copper.
Okay.
And they've got, I can't remember what the word is to describe their particular property that makes them do this. I've got it written down. But what we were finding was that the copper-coated components in the rotor were being drawn to the spinning water. So we were having a water spinning in a pipe. Not only was it pushing the rotor in terms of just a straightforward push, but the other face was being drawn in by the copper coating. And if we put... I think it was 5% gold in, we could get a 15 or 20% improvement in the performance. So this was given during one of the early inquiries. So I kind of extended that to try and work out why the fish, or how the fish, remains stationary in fast flowing water. Because there are lots of components, as John says. You've got the golf ball dimpling effect of the scales. You've got the soliton possibly pulsing. You've got the fins just twisted into a spiral of water like a sailboat.
Yeah.
You've got all those components, but there was something else. Why does it only flee upstream? How does it get up the waterfall? And what we seemed to be getting was that the fish is also a bipolar thing, and the scales give it the kind of like the bipolar effect.
So what, electrically bipolar?
Yes.
Really charged?
Yes, or bipolar. Mm. Flatties are less bipolar, flatfish, but normal fish are bipolar. So what I was kind of shown to do was to get a stage prop trout, a perfect shape of a trout, fill it with sand until it just sank or just floated, coat it with copper and stick it in the water and see how much kind of the copper changed the tug.
Yeah.
Now, it didn't change it particularly at all just by copper coating it. But when I slit the copper just by running a Stanley blade into two halves separated by a small gap, we got something like a 20% reduction in drag on the scales in the water. So we were seeing something as a result of scraping that groove in the copper that coated the trout.
Wow.
Don't know.
That just all makes me think that it's all a lot more complicated out there. I mean, that's an amazing thing for a trout to be able to do, isn't it, in all honesty.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've got John and John waiting to come and have a chat with us now, but it's been really great to hear that. Yeah.
So,
what are you going to do next? Where are you working towards?
Peeling the whole planet.
Right.
That's our instruction.
Yeah.
And we're on it and we're loving it.
Brilliant. Well, thanks a lot for coming and chatting to us about it. It's really nice to see people kind of actually implementing Schauberger's ideas, because they are pretty inspired.
Yeah, it is. And thanks for listening.
Very good. Thanks a lot, okay, Noel. I'll catch you later on, mate. Yeah, I'm just going to put on another tune whilst we get some more people into the van. That was Noel and John Bide, who've been talking to us a little bit about subtle energies that are appearing both in terms of lift and in terms of water. Energies that are working somehow in the other direction from where we've been looking. And John's been saying that we only find what we try to measure, and because we haven't tried to measure any of these strange forms of levitating energy, it's like they're not really there. But the work is being done. All fed and back behind the microphone again, and I've now got John Witterick with me, who is known to the world as the person who sorts out the getoutofdebtfree.org.
That's correct.
Yeah, and I think he's going to be talking a little bit about that and a little bit about some other stuff he's doing. So we've already had a little bit of a chat about the trout, and
very interesting. I've read a lot of Victor Schraberger's work as well, so for me, fascinating. I was listening in on it.
Yeah. Like you say, we have got to put the bends back in the rivers.
We certainly have, yeah. Just, put the bends back in everything.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I'm not sure if you mentioned it, but I can remember looking at this graph of when you spin water and put it down a pipe, and you actually get it where, you know, the more water you put through when it's spinning, the friction goes up and then it drops down. And it goes back up again, and the second time it drops down below the baseline, which they call negative friction, which I think is actually over unity energy. So,
It's once again looking at something that is invisible because we haven't been looking for it.
Totally. Yeah. And also, people think that our heart is a pump. Well, I used to be a pneumatics engineer, and I know how much friction there is in small tubing. And how much pressure you've got to do to get to get a fluid. Can you imagine how many miles of small capillaries?
Mm.
And it's because I think the heart is a vortex generator. and that's how it gets the the actual, that's how the blood goes through our bodies. It's the same way as the water does.
That's right. And this was the stuff that John was talking about when he said they said basically that a golf ball would go all over the place if it didn't have the little dimples on it, and the little dimples create micro vortices, which are what, and of course that's happening all the way through our blood and lymph systems and all of that. There's a lot of little vortices, aren't there? So loads of stuff is driving itself along, using only the energy that it's using to drive itself along.
That's right, yeah.
Excellent. So in this world of increasing debt, now that everybody's in debt to everybody else, how's it going out on the website? Are you finding yourself kept busy?
Of course, we get very, very busy. What I feel, because I look at the figures on Google, analytics, and we see how many people we've had visiting, and I find the website's a very good indicator of how people are waking up. And this year, of course, it's going through the ceiling. And it's just people are thinking, hang on, there's got to be a better way. And I think originally when I started, I was thinking, well, there's got to be a way of dealing with this. I've just got to find it. And for me, I came across Mary Elizabeth Croft originally.
Yeah.
I still think her work is brilliant. And she never actually put the letters up, and she never gave, she gave us a good idea what to put in the letters, but she never actually gave us a template. And I'm thinking, and this must have been about 6 years ago, I was thinking, well, somebody's got to have come up with a way of actually dealing with letters, but which is actually in alignment with everything else, because I was starting to meditate and eat a bit more properly and started, doing things like that. But there's one part of my life that I couldn't get in balance. And the debt collectors used to phone me up and my voice would all go wobbly and sort of like, I'd go, hello. And I was thinking, what the hell's going on here? So what I had to do is find a way of empowering myself to actually stand up to these crooks, as I believe they are now. And I don't mean your local bank manager's a crook, because just recently we interviewed a bank manager and he was a really lovely guy, and he was also quite cynical about the banking system.
Does he know what's going on?
He's got a very good idea what's going on. He he'd actually done a degree in economics before he started banking. And then he started in 2008, and of course, everything went tits up. Yeah. And so what he did, he sort of started thinking, well, hang on. He started looking deeper into it. So, he realised that, hang on, this is all a little bit strange. And fair enough, we asked him some questions, quite good questions. And one of them is like, what happens to all the, when you sign your loan agreement, what happens to them? And basically, they're all bundled up and securitized, which means effectively the way I see it is, I'll come on to promissory notes in a minute, because that's something we started on the website having a lot of fun with. What basically, when you fill in your loan agreement, what you're doing, you're signing it, and they turn that becomes a promissory note. Now, the great thing is that can be sold on to the Bank of England. So effectively, the bank didn't have any money to loan you in the first place. It hasn't got any money to loan you. There is no money. The idea that it's everyone else's savings, that is rubbish. And the idea it's a loan, they should be done under the Trades Descriptions Act, because it's not a loan, because they haven't got any money to loan you. That's why they need LIBOR, because just overnight, the fluctuations in the amount of money, they have to borrow, borrow money off each other. And that's like this whole, it's like an overnight lending rate,
And I mean, it's just as a point of interest, it has been known for some time that those rates were being fixed, I think since at least 2007. And it's quite clear that it is with the approbation of the financial securities people and with government. So all this shock and horror that seems to be coming about is a bit of a surprise to me. I don't know about you.
Well, it wasn't a surprise to the governor of the Bank of England, because I think he was actually notified 4 years ago. So I think that, basically that kid that, during the London riots, there's one lad that picked up a bottle of water that was on the ground, which had been dropped from somebody that's pinched it from a supermarket. And they got, they actually got put away for a couple of months or something ridiculous. And so, if Cameron's going to say, well, we can't have these, if he's going to make a sort of like be tough on crime, then he's got to be tough on his mates, you know, who are the biggest criminals. In fact,
do you think there's any progress towards that kind of thing? Is it still working on the individual level, or is we starting to get more complex in our approaches to the problem?
Well, I think there's lots of people looking at alternatives now. Obviously, you've got Roger Hayes with his, you know, with his lawful bank, and yeah, a lot of other things. At the moment, I mean, the way we're doing it, I think there are a few people getting braver. I mentioned that we've got promissory notes on the website, because I was saying, you know, they actually securitize, which means they sell off your loan agreement effectively, because they turn it, it's a promissory note. Yeah. So they can sell that because it's worth money on the international exchanges. So the ridiculous thing, and they do it with mortgage agreements as well, which is why the banks very rarely have your original mortgage agreement. So, but the thing is, they then expect you to pay them back. Well, I'm sorry, well, you've already been paid. Yeah, with my signature created the money, effectively. Your signature is all you need. So what we're doing now, we've got a promissory note template on the website, and we're getting people paying the bills with them. And it doesn't work every time, but there's, you'd be surprised how many people have been successful with it. So, yeah, it's quite exciting.
Have you any idea what the difference is between those that are working and those that aren't? Is...
I don't, but what we're doing, we're getting a lot of feedback on the forum about people. What is nice is at the moment there's a couple of lads, they won't mind me using their first names, I'm sure, because they've been out on videos. There's Martin and Paul, and in fact, I'm hoping to go back via Bristol and go and interview them and make a, you know, put a video together. But what Martin did, and they're both very, very knowledgeable. They've done a lot of homework around promissory notes. And so what they've done, Martin started it off. He got a promissory note and filled it in. It was about £4,000 to pay off his overdraft. And what he did, he paid it into, one of these automated payment things, puts it in the envelope, puts it in the machine, presses the buttons. Great. So a few days later, looks at his account, nothing. So he phones up the bank, and of course this is recorded and goes out on a video. So he sort of phoned him up, said, excuse me, I've paid him £4,000 in cash, and it hasn't appeared to show on my account. And of course they're panicking. They're saying, well, we haven't had any, you know, discrepancies at our end, you know. And so they're going on for about 10 minutes, and she's obviously panicking, the poor woman, because that's a lot of money for a... You know, banks are, you know, normally try and balance their books, yeah. In the way that they do it anyway. But with their fiat currency. But anyway, she said, well, can you give me a breakdown of the notes? And he said, oh, well, there was just one note. And then she twigged and she said, ah, right, the promissory note. that obviously come across, they clocked it. Now, but the thing is, you see, The bizarre thing is that they actually held on to the original and only gave Martin back a photocopy with copy written on it.
Surely retaining the original.
Retaining the original, and yet not actually. So why is it they didn't? Because if you gave me some Mickey Mouse money, I'd say, no, I'm not having your Mickey Mouse money. I can't buy a beer over there with it. So there you go. And you give it. No, they took it back and gave back a photocopy. So and these lads are clever, you know, they know what they're doing. So that they actually spoke to the bank manager, and she was being quite very sort of almost apologetic. She said, well, look, whatever happened, she said, obviously you know a little bit about this because of the way you're talking. And she said, well, can we have it in writing that whatever you do is going to actually be lawful? Because all we want is, you know, to actually obey the law, okay, on this. And she said, well, you have my word. And they also said, when you write to us, can you sign the letter in ink, please? Not one of these computer signatures. So she said, yes, okay. And they said, well, you know, can we just have something in writing just to say that you're going to do that? She said, no, you're going to have to trust me. So he said, oh, so so you're going to be a trustee. That makes me the benefactor. And so, like, they're starting. She said, oh, you're putting words in my mouth now. And like, really, it's quite panicking her. But, of course,
they wouldn't accept it. And then they said, they get something back from the legal department saying that there has to be a third party involved. And he phones them back up and says, well, hang on, this is not true. I mean, we know that Lord Denning said a promissory note is as good as cash. And so they're now challenging the bank, and it's ongoing. And they're also talking about getting the fraud squad in because they think there could be securities fraud going on. So these guys are going to push it with the bank all the way. Now, when I spoke to our little bank manager, I say a little bank manager, he was actually a branch manager of a town branch, you know, so I can't say where because we've had to, he'd lose his job if, but he was very good. He sat with us for a whole evening for an hour and a half answering all our questions, and also said that, you know, anything else, you know, do give us a shout. So,
is that available up on YouTube to have a look at?
Yes, it's available on YouTube. You can find a link to it from our website. It's actually on the front page of the website on the left hand side. So if you go to getoutofdebtfree.org, I think there's a link to it on the left-hand side of the page. But it's worth having a look at, Banking Insider. And we actually asked him, well, look, if I come to you with a promissory note, do you have to accept it? And he said, yeah, of course we do. So if I come to you with a promissory note, you're going to accept it? He said, no. And we said, so legally you have to accept it, yes, but you're not going to. No. Eve's right up front with it. So these guys know. Well, I don't think, he said most bank managers wouldn't know that. It's just that he'd done his homework and he could tell us the difference between a bill of exchange and a promissory note, and he'd done his, you know, he was pretty hot, and that's why he was quite happy to come and talk to us, because he wasn't sort of, we were saying to you, knowing what you know, what are you doing being a bank manager? And he said, well, you know, at the end of the day, it's a job, you know. And he said, what I pride myself in is, you know, giving my customers the best deal they can get. And if somebody comes in that's bankrupt and, you know, they can't get a bank account, and so basically it stops people getting a lot of jobs if they haven't got a bank account. He's always like happy to actually, you know, ensure that people get a bank account. So he had a heart, basically. Yeah, that was nice. So.
Yeah. With the promissory notes, you're presumably just going to keep encouraging people to use them in certain applications and see how well they work. I mean, it'd be interesting to know, for example, because quite often what happens, isn't it, is you come up with a solution that seems to work until, say, the next round of council tax, and then they'll come back at you with a... So have you managed to offload sort of several promissory notes on anybody's, or is it still kind of a one-at-a-time job?
Well, I haven't actually got that many bills myself, because I've dealt with my council tax some time back. Just in case there's anyone working for the council out there, unlikely to be listening to this radio station. But I sort of got under the radar a long time. I lived in the woods for 9 months and just didn't come back onto the radar. So there's always different ways of dealing with these things. So I haven't actually got a lot of bills apart from my O2 bill or something like that. But I haven't actually tried one personally, because I haven't got any sort of big bills that come up, because I'm living in a house where people in the house pay the bills. So I haven't used it, but a lot of people on the site have used it. And, you know, if you go to the forum, there's something called Success Stories. And in there, you can see a lot of people have used A4V successfully. So, yeah, it's really exciting. It's really exciting. I feel that people are waking up to the whole fact that the banking system is totally fraudulent. And people don't realise it, you know, especially if somebody, you know, I can remember talking to a chap who'd done a degree in economics. And he couldn't see it, because he's going, but if you take into inflation and this and that, and I go, no. And what I do, I try and keep things really, really simple, because I've got quite a simple brain. And I'm sure, I'm not saying, you're listening to TNS, I'm sure there's some of the brightest people on the planet. However, I like to keep things really, really simple. And people do like it if you keep it fairly simple, but explain what's going on. And what I do is I have a little bag and I've got 10 marbles in it. And I say to people, look, 10 marbles in this bag, okay? You can't get 11 out. There's no way. The 11th marble doesn't exist, okay? You can only get, you know, you take 10 marbles out, put 10 marbles back in. You can't get 11 out. So the whole point is, with money, they make money out of thin air, and then they want more back. Well, that money they want back doesn't exist, and it will never exist, and it can't exist. And it's like playing musical chairs. Because if everyone's up dancing, having a bit of a laugh, and then somebody sneaks in, takes one of the chairs, the music stops, somebody ends up on their ass. And that's what you're seeing at the moment. You're seeing it globally, you're seeing it nationally, you're seeing it in businesses, and you're seeing it with individuals. Everyone's in debt because the, you know, 11th marble doesn't exist. And that's how I think of it. It's that simple. When you make money, you know, when you create it as debt, instead, I mean, the government shouldn't be in debt, because if it needs money, it has the authority to create it itself. So why is it borrowing it? You know, well, you know, and all these politicians that say, ah, well, we've got to pay off the deficit and we, you know, the national debt and that. And somebody's worked out that we're actually paying 76 pence in every pound collected from council tax is actually going in interest payments.
So that's nearly three quarters. That's just over three quarters of all of it. And there's to say that quite a lot of the rest of it's going for fighting illegal wars. It is a discussion I occasionally have with people, because they do say to me, they say, but, you know, if you're not paying tax, so do you want to go back to the Stone Age? Do you want to go back to feudalism and things? And you've just got to ask people whether they really believe that the enormous amounts of money, the trillions and trillions of euros or whatever it is that they're calling it, that they're actually coming out of the remnants of people actually working and paying tax. Because we know anyway that most of the people earning the big amounts of money are pretty skillful tax evaders, quite apart from anything else.
Well, yeah, that's the whole thing. They keep saying that the City of London, you know, it makes lots of money for Britain. Well, A, they don't pay any tax in the City of London, because, you know, they've got this. That's not even a democracy. The City of London is a separate country, effectively, you know. So that's one thing. But to actually create wealth, one has to either be of service or create something, you know, like, you know, somebody building a car or growing vegetables or whatever, you know, a farmer's or whatever. However, if all you're doing is playing around on a computer and in make-believe markets, which are being, you know, manipulated anyway, in my opinion, you're not actually creating anything. And yet these guys are the best paid, you know, the highest paid in the land. Not the nurses or the doctors or whatever. It's bloody people on computers. It's crazy. It is absolutely crazy. And the idea that we can pay off the deficit, all you have to do is go to the Bank of England website, have a look at the money supply, the amount of money in, you know, actually floating around out there in banks and in people's pockets. And it's nowhere near the, I think it's well over $1 trillion that we owe. And if that was printed out in £50 notes and palletized, it would cover a football pitch and a half, and that's two pallets high. You know, so the amount is just ridiculous. You know, a trillion grains of sand weigh 72 tons. Yeah, so you get an idea how big a trillion is, and you think if we're paying just you know a couple of percent on that, it's billions of pounds we're just giving away.
There's somebody in the chat box at TNS who suggested, Scottish Sovereigns, in fact, who suggested a debt jubilee, actually cancelling all of the debts. What do you think of that as an idea?
I think that's the best idea we've had for most definitely, and that was the idea of a jubilee originally, wasn't it? And in the Mayan calendar, they had one calendar where, and I think it was something like every 5 years, all the debts were annulled, you know, because they didn't want a society where, you know, it's like Monopoly. The person with the most money, you know, who starts off and starts with a slight advantage, immediately has the advantage. So the more money you have, the more money you can make.
and also, of course, by not retiring the debt, as it were, by not sort of having a jubilee and writing it off, and by not retiring the promissory notes, effectively what's happening is it's not just our debt, it's the debt of our parents and our grandparents, and it's now being handed on to our children and their children.
Yeah, and that's the really sad thing, is what sort of world are we creating for our children? But, I mean, there's a simple way out. And there's a country that's, if you think, hang on, which country's had a bit of problem, had a few problems in 2008. And I can remember it very clearly because I was listening to Moneybox Live because it was getting interesting, because they had the head of the Icelandic bank. And they were saying, and the chap that was interviewing him was saying, some of our listeners are phoning up saying they have problems getting money from their cash machines. And he's saying, oh, no, it's not a problem. We've got a problem with our website. Nothing. And I'm thinking, that's not true. That's not true. Because this was at a time when, I think Lehman's and AIG were having problems. And but the great thing now is, and I'm sure most of your listeners are aware of this because it's not on the mainstream news, but it's all over the internet, is what Iceland have done. And what they did, they've basically got rid of all their fraudulent bankers. Some of them are actually now facing justice and actually having court cases. And they're also kicking out their corrupt MPs as well. And they've created a new constitution. Now, it's that simple. That's all we have to do.
Have they got a new bank as well? And what do they do with the banking system? Did they completely renew it, or have they just...
Well, I know historically what happened is that they had a banking system which worked quite nicely for many years, and they had four nationalised banks. And then somebody suggested, it'd be a really good idea if you privatized them and deregulated them. So they privatized and deregulated them all at once. And of course, that's when they started offering, even our local council in Birkbeck, in Dorset, where I live, that had a few million in there. And I'm thinking, what are they doing putting their money into Iceland, for goodness sake, And the crazy thing was that, It was set up to fail. It was like a Ponzi scheme. But our current financial system is like a Ponzi scheme, like a pyramid scheme, where it just needs lots of people putting in more money. Because there's two things. Because of this, going back to the marbles again, because we're always short of that marble, two things have to happen as a result. Looking at the money supply is like marbles. We have to have more money being pumped in the whole time. It has to, because as soon as you stop pumping more money in, the whole game will collapse. And the other thing, of course, is people will obviously go bankrupt, and they have to default, because it's not just an option, it's actually built into the system. So this is the problem with the banking system. And so when I get people saying, oh, I'm having, and it's really sad. Some of the stories you hear about people that, had an accident or lost their job, or, it's, and some people get suicidal. And it really does affect people, this debt. And they don't realise that the system is just a Mickey Mouse system that is designed to get people in debt, because it's a way of controlling people. Just like the television is, and just like these stupid laws are. And it's just, and I think it's probably one of the most powerful ways that people actually are controlled, because subconsciously you've got that control all the time. You're thinking, oh, I can't afford that. Oh, I really like one of those, but I can't afford it. So you've got this little dialogue going on in your head the whole time. So,
what do you think of the fact that it seems to me that I know that, was it the HBOS had a bit of, and the Dublin Bank had a bit of trouble with their software systems, and people couldn't get money out for 2 or 3 weeks. I noticed that it was happening in other parts of the world as well. There's just a bank here and a bank there. Do you think all of those are just coincidence?
I haven't got any proof either way. However, I'm sure like me, I tend to see things and smell a bit of a rat. And I'm thinking, right, well, hang on, there's something going on here. Because if they've, for a start, if it is their computer systems, then they're obviously being really underfunded, and yeah, they haven't been upgrading, have they, or doing backups or doing everything that we're supposed to do with our PC. So, you know, but the fact that it's not just one bank, and the fact that some people couldn't withdraw money for getting on for 4 weeks.
It was a long time.
And of course, it's just created more and more problems. But, you know, a few more of those, and we could see a complete run on the bank, and which would create a crash, you know. And so I personally think that although it can be very, very difficult for a lot of people, that the system has to crash sooner or later. And the sooner it does, I think the better for everyone. I really believe that, because it will, we'll have to realize that, no, we can't go on. I've got a graph that I put up when I do my talk, and it shows the increase in the money supply since sort of 1800. And in the last 4 years, it sort of goes up. Second World War, you could hardly see the blip. And then in the 70s, it just starts coming off the baseline and just starts coming up. And then the last 4 years, it goes off the screen. It's crazy. So we really need a new banking system, and I think, and that's why I encourage people to default if they can't afford to pay their debt, is to get onto the website. And it's not just defaulting, but it's actually challenging them. So what you do, you write to your bank, and the letters basically say, well, first off, prove that I owe you something, show us the accounting. Secondly, prove that we've got a contract, because we said to our friendly bank manager, you know, the when somebody does an application form, can you tell us, you know, we sign that. Does the bank sign it? I said, well, human beings don't sign it. He said, it's covered in signatures from the, you know, the head of credit risk, but they're all computer signatures. So they don't, because they know that if they sign it, it's like the bank manager that signed Martin's letter. She actually took liability, because once you sign it, that's your signature backing it up, not the corporation, you see. That's why they won't sign it. It's like it's why court bailiffs don't chase council tax for don't chase council tax, because any court bailiff knows that if he's actually push comes, you know, they'll chase it through from the sort of county courts, but not these little these little courts, you know, they where, you know, the council tax courts, because they know they're unlawful. So it's almost like we're seeing the whole system unraveling anyway. There's only a sort of matter of time now before I think the whole lot comes crashing down. And, you know, we're just going to be brave like Iceland and decide, right, you know, we really don't have to pay it back. Because at the end of the day, there's no way we can pay it back. And, but, you know, we do try and encourage people, obviously, you know, don't be greedy. You know, if you can't pay it back, then that's one thing. But if you decide that you actually want to go and get loads and loads of credit cards and just use them to go and buy a new Porsche, then you're just being greedy, and you're not actually, you're no better than the bankers in that case. So it's a matter of, yeah, if you're in trouble, you know, by all means, or if you have to feed your kids or whatever, you know, by all means, use the letters. But, you know, don't use it to actually, you know, just buy more and more things that you need, because that's being greedy, and that's out of balance. You're going to be out of balance with the universe.
And it is important, if we're genuinely going to see this thing being drawn to a halt, it's something I'm sure we'll be talking with Darren about. If we're going to see it drawn to a halt, it's necessary for us as individuals to start drawing it to a halt. Yeah. I remain permanently astonished by the fact that there doesn't appear to me to be any kind of response to what the banks are doing and to what they evidently are. I mean, I left them over 15 years ago, and since then it's just become more and more apparent what's happening. And it's astonishing that we don't seem to have developed any workable alternative. I mean, Rogers Lawful Bank, if it were to work, is a very young thing, and as far as I know, is the only game out there, apart from our mathematically perfected economy, which is talked about on TNS.
Yes.
But I mean, I don't know. What do you see there being any solution to the disappearance of the money? Do you think people will rise to the challenge?
Yeah, I do. There's Bitcoin, and that's been that's a great one, because it's It's there's no central computer, and it's on sort of everyone's computer. It's one of these very clever. It's working on a BitTorrent system, and that's been quite successful. It started off, and it sort of a lot of people actually made a lot of money because lots of people joined, and that, you know, the price of them went up suddenly, and then it's dropped off, but it's coming back up again. But the difficulty is that we need a workable system that you can go to the pub and buy a pint of beer with, or a loaf of bread, or you know, just and so a lot of these things, you can use them for some things, but you can't use them for everything, you know. And it's really annoying, because I would really like an alternative to PayPal to use on the website, because we take donations. But you know, really, there's nothing at the moment that people sort of trust enough to use. So yeah, it's a challenge at the moment. However, it's not always going to be like that. People are waking up, and I feel that this year is really the year. Just the shift, you know, in energy that people have got. You know, it's remarkable, and so I'm really, really excited that we're coming to a conclusion here. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all happening at such speed now, isn't it? And here we are kind of like talking about all of this and all the difficulties with the money supply and people kind of getting more and more into debt and stuff. And what's the government choosing to do but put on a massive festival of running, jumping and standing still? I gather that's attracted your attention recently as well.
Yeah, well, it's like an overblown sports day, isn't it? But it's, you know, this year it's really been like the Olympic War Games, hasn't it? You know, how crazy, it's at the end of the day, it's supposed to be a sporting event. And so they've got, you know, missiles on roofs. They've got, you know, police with, you know, submachine guns. It's absolutely crazy. But what's really interested me is the whole symbology and the layout of it as well, where the actual, where the stadium is. And everything from the, this whole torch ceremony, we think, oh, wow, that's amazing, because that must go back to ancient Greece. And, of course, it doesn't go back to ancient Greece at all. It was actually Goring's idea in 1936, when Hitler's, you know, when they had the, when it was in Germany. So, and those were the first, because they thought, you know, Goring thought he, you know, he was in charge of propaganda, and he thought it would add a little bit of sort of, make it more like the original Greek Olympics, where, you know, there's no talk of the torch, you know. But it's the symbolism, it's everything to do with that. It's the whole idea of Prometheus. And I don't think it's any coincidence that the film Prometheus actually came out in June this year. So, you know, it's absolutely fascinating. Yeah, the other thing is you look at the Olympic mascots as well, and you know that everyone sort of, you know, those people that haven't taken notice of them, you think, what's that all about? You know, because these funny little guys with one eye, and of course, if you know anything about Greek philosophy, you know that they're cyclops, and so you read a little bit on Greek mythology, and you realise that they are actually created. They were blacksmiths of the gods, yeah. And they created Poseidon, Neptune's trident, and all these, you know, various different swords and things. Yeah. Now, in the little film, there's a little film made about how these Olympic mascots were made, and the film was for kids, but of course everyone was watching them because there's got to be some symbology in here. And of course we weren't. But the way these two little mascots in their little promo film. What they had this huge long steel pole, and it was supposed to be part of the Olympics. And this great, and I will say, because we're talking symbology here, this long phallic looking pole, the end of it flashed and it went blob, blob from one end of it. And these two blobs came out, and those ended up, you know, somebody picked them up and took them home, made them into the mascots. And that's how, so it's all to do. They kept the Cyclops thing of being, you know, the molten metal, because that's very important in mythology. And it's not just, it's all the occult knowledge, if you like, you know.
And there was a lot of that, I know, as well, in the previous Olympics, that one in Germany. I've just been required to go away and sort out somebody else's technical problem, because for those of us where the radio show is coming tonight live from
the Green Gathering, where I'm helping to run an arena, and there's a bit of a technical problem over in the main tent. So I'm going to have to stop you there, John, but thank you very much for that. I'm going to put on some tunes whilst I go and sort this out. It shouldn't take very long. And also at the same time, I'll try and find either Darren Diogi or Sean to speak to. So I'm sorry for the interruption to that interview. We're going
Enjoyed it.
Going strong there, but this is the sort of thing that does happen around here. So,
great to see you again.
Yeah, it's great to see you again. I'm looking forward to the talk and hearing more on that.
Yeah, well, we'll have a fun weekend.
It's going to be another busy weekend, without a doubt. In the meantime, folks, I'll just put on a bit of music whilst I go and see if I can sort out what's happening out there on the outside the van, and I'll be back with you soon. My apologies if anything breaks down whilst my back's turned. I know that taking your eyes off these machines is a poor idea, but we'll put it on cue, get it to play you some music, and I will be back with you as soon as I can. There we go. That seems to have got all of that sorted out. So we're back in the van. Hopefully everything was working all right whilst I was out there running around in the field, failing to get the thing sorted out, but luckily the man that did sort it out is with me now. We've got a few minutes of Sean's time, and Sean's the man who, for as long as I've been involved with Avalon Rising, has been the first person to get on the site and put it together and faces all the technical challenges. Thanks for finding a few minutes, Sean.
Oh, it's great to be here, Nick.
It might be interesting to hear just a little bit about what it's like to arrive in a field when there's nothing here and sort out, you know, because we've got power, we've got food, we've got two arenas that we're running, there's the Fairy Glade. I mean, how long has it been part of your mission, this particular fest?
Well, this particular one, it starts obviously months in advance. But actually arriving on site is really nice because there's no one here. And you've got this we're on a beautiful site, absolutely stunning old oak trees everywhere, and beautiful views of the Severn. So actually arriving is a real treat because it's such a beautiful place. And then it slowly unravels and the stress level builds and builds as things happen and don't happen and various levels of efficiency and inefficiency. But yeah, we have created quite an amazing space this time. We created a fairy glen and a mini stone circle around it, and which Nick helped me build, incidentally. And, two venues, Auriga Space and Avalon Rising. Avalon Rising's been going for quite a few years. The first one, actually, was way back in 2005. So we have been around festivals quite a long time. We even tried Glastonbury one year, and it happened to be the year that that everyone remembers, the 2007 Glastonbury, where everyone got completely flooded and we're in the teepee field kind of steering a wall of mud past our front door of our yurt, and we've never been back since. But Sunrise, we do Sunrise quite a lot, and obviously the Green Gathering, me and my friend Hugh were coordinating Earth Energies for a number of years, so now it's gone into its smaller phase, regenerating the green spirit, and they asked us to do it again, and we did. So we're here.
Yeah, for another year, and it all sort of set itself about running pretty much on time, didn't it, really?
Yeah, fine. Bit late. Printing was late. A few things were late, so people didn't know what was going on. But now we've got all our printing and everything's going out, so tomorrow's a new day and everything will run.
Of course, one of your strengths is the you do dowsing workshops, so as well as setting it up once, like most of our crew actually, we help set up and then do some presenting as well. So what have you got lined up for us this time around?
Well, I teach dowsing. I'm also a geomancer, and I build sacred sites, stone circles, labyrinths. So I teach people to douse. Also how to heal the earth, which is, you know, really important these kind of technological times. There's a lot of what we dowsers call geopathic stress, which can build up in the underground water veins of the earth, and it's not helped by the addition of kind of mobile phones and Wi-Fi signals and all that EM. And as you know, water kind of absorbs that and can carry that kind of energy in the earth. So I teach people how to douse for water, how to deal with geopathic stress if it's going in their own home. And, you know, it's in Europe, they're much more aware of this problem. For example, in, I think it's Sweden or Scandinavia somewhere, they actually call in dowsers to dowse a property before it's even built. So they're in with the planning stage of the building, and it's really important because they have a lot of kind of fault lines, and in this country, and you know, particularly volcanic countries, there's a lot of what they call radon gas, which comes up through fault lines and things. So that's a real problem. So yeah, they call dowsers in to kind of diagnose the site to see if they can actually build. Now, I doubt if Wimpy have ever thought of that, or Barrett, or any of these other places. They just don't consider that as a problem.
Speaking as somebody who does the new build gardening, I can say they definitely don't consider that as a problem.
And it can lead to all kinds of problems, because you don't actually know if you've built on a fault line unless you talk to a geologist or someone. So, and you know, these problems, although, you know, there's just not much awareness of it, but actually this stuff can be really serious, can cause cancer, ME, all kinds of illness. And it's really specific to where the energy lines are flowing, particularly if it's flowing through a bed. So if it's flowing through the bottom half of the bed, you'll have foot problems and or knee problems, and it'll just basically be really specific to where the energy's flowing. This is from first-hand experience, that both my grandparents died of similar stomach cancers, and my granddad, after my nan died, moved into her bed, and so then he was in that same field and got bowel cancer and died, you know, basically 2 years later. So it really is that specific, and he was in fine health before he swapped beds.
And if you pay attention to some of this stuff, obviously there's things you can do about it, having detected whatever it is.
Absolutely, that's what I teach. That's basically what I teach, how to deal with these. They're kind of radiations, shall we say, emanating from the underground water. And the underground water can be, you know, really 400 or 500 feet deep. But if it's a really strong flow, it can its radiation will penetrate a tower block.
And of course, loads and loads of our water is put in conduits under the cities now, isn't it? There's rivers. Most of the main rivers run under cities now.
Yeah, it's not so much rivers that are the problem. It's the deep underground water that can create this geopathic stress. I'll give you another quick example, because soon after I trained as a geomancer, I was with my uncle in Washington, and he just bought a new house, and he got a kind of good deal on this house because the guy who sold it had a brain tumor. And he went to the country to convalesce. And I'd just come back from my geomancy training. And he said, can you douse my house out? Yeah. And then he told me this story about this guy, the brain tumor. And I said, well, where have you got your bed now? And he said, well, the same place it was when we saw the house. And so we doused the bed. And sure enough, under the bed headboard of the bed was this blind spring. And a blind spring is like a water pocket that is met an impermeable layer of rock. So the water builds up like a reservoir under there. And this was right under the headboard. And of course, that energy was really geopathically stressed, which is why he had the brain tumor. So luckily for my uncle, I was there to kind of diagnose that, because, you know, what would have happened? My uncle could have got sick. My auntie could have got sick. You know, so it's just fortunate, and it's just lack of awareness that this is a real problem in, you know, particularly fault-rich areas, that people get all kinds of illnesses when they move to a particular house, and they don't know why. They've been fine before, they move to this house, and then they get sick. They move away from the house, and they start getting better.
Yeah.
And this is the reason. So it is really my kind of mission, if you like, is to promote awareness of earth energies, because a lot of earth energies are very good. Let's be completely honest. A lot of earth energies are life enhancing. That's what the ancients knew when they built stone circles. They created places where the life force or energy ley lines converge, where there's life enhancing, not only for their own ceremonies, but also the crops and also the animals.
And these are presumably ancient energies that they're finding. The stone circles actually mark points where these energy lines converge, do they?
Yeah, it's a great question. People say, what came first, stone circle or the energy line? And it's a chicken and egg one, because basically it's both. You can put a stone circle on a good spot, or you can make a stone circle which is really well aspected, and that will bring in the earth energies. So it's a bit of both. But obviously, I think our ancestors were a bit more in tune with all this kind of stuff. So they understood the need to be in particular places at particular times, which is why a lot of stone circles are calendrical. So they represent like particular rises and sets of the sun and moon and things, and eclipses. So, you know, depending what the function of the site is, there will be a particular sunrise which is marked, and that will be the when the site really powers up. But it's interesting how our ancestors found out this, and there've been a lot of books written about this. How early man decided to work with earth energies, and I think the answer is really simple. They were following the animals, and the animals were following the energy. So when cows and things migrate, well, ancient cows, not these days. When ancient cows migrated over the plains, they would be following energy lines, because a lot of Britain today, a lot of the energies are pinned. They're pinned by sacred sites. They're pinned by churches. But you know, it's interesting that in kind of Aboriginal culture, the lines move. Like the rainbow serpent moves across the land. It's not in the same place. It comes with the rain and it goes, you know, it moves about.
So we might be expecting our energy centers to do the same, and they're not because of our architectures.
Because of the way we're using, the way the megalithic culture started to kind of tame the land, if you like, tame the dragons, the earth dragons.
Yeah. So it actually is channeling the, it was in those days at least, channeling the energy for specific use, do you think?
I think, yeah, definitely. I mean, you don't build a great big stone circle and then do nothing with it. They obviously had some sort of ceremonial ritual. Perhaps they were... I mean, I've been into stone circles for a while. There's a few in Dartmoor that I went to see recently that really kind of blew me away, because they had angles that represented basically the plane of the ecliptic and the tropics. Mm-hmm. So they knew what latitude they were on.
Yeah.
They were able to find their own latitude.
Yeah.
And this is with using basically the setting and setting of the sun at equinox.
Later on, I'm going to be doing my talk, which is called Calendar's Prophecy and the History of Time. And it spends its first kind of 60 minutes plotting the incredibly complex development of this lunatic calendar that we've got, and the whole thing has to be delivered. This is all presented as history, that one person discovered the geometry and then somebody else discovered there were spheres rotating in elliptical orbits around the earth and all this, and there's names attached to all of the people who discovered these things way into effectively the second millennium of the common era. And yet we know that the people that built Stonehenge, the people that built Newgrange, must have known all this stuff, because they couldn't have built they couldn't have done the things they did otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, Stonehenge is, you know, really special, classic example of, you know, it does so many things. It's got the lunation triangle, which basically, or lunation rectangle, which basically predicts the minor and major standstills of the moon, which is a 19-year cycle.
Yeah,
and they thought that with using that and the number of stones around, you could actually predict eclipses, and people like Robin Heath and Jean Michel have proven that you can actually do that.
Yeah, and that. Look, how do you think? Because I mean, really, as we're going to hear later, a lot of calendars developed out of some pretty simple observations. You can't develop something like Stonehenge or Newgrange out of simple observations. It seems to me that there must have been some way of record in order for something as complex as Stonehenge or Newgrange really to exist. There must have been some record of recording information in order to make sure that you could put it where it was needed to be. Do you have any thoughts on how those records might have been kept?
Well, I don't know if you know about the the, some of the copper plates they found.
I do. Copper and gold they've found there, haven't
yeah.
they?
Yeah. And there's they're basically diamonds with various patterns on. I've forgotten the exact term they're called, but they found a couple of them, and they tend to, the angles suggest that they were using Pythagorean geometry, and also that at certain latitudes they correspond to the solstices. So it's really handy if you're designing a sacred site to have your little diamond, and you find out which latitude you're on, then you can use that diamond anywhere on that latitude to make a sacred site.
And of course, latitude to latitude would yield a different shaped diamond.
That's right. This is some of the work in Uriel's machine. Forgotten their names, who wrote that book.
No, I can't remember their names, but I do refer to the book a fair bit.
Yeah, and basically, as you go up, the as you go towards the equator, the diamond gets kind of fatter, and you know, until you get to at the equator, it's basically a line. But as you go up towards north, it gets more pointy. So you get this kind of with latitude, and it's interesting. There's a classic one, Brinkethley D, that the angle, because that's exactly 53 degrees latitude, and the sun sets, when you take into account the mountain, exactly 53 degrees. So the sunset and the latitude are the same. So if they needed a sunset and a latitude which are the same, what are they calculating? Are they calculating longitude? What are they doing? So they knew the latitude because they chose this site because the sun sets at 53 degrees from this site, and it's at latitude 53 degrees. Same at Stonehenge, 51 degrees sunrise. Summer solstice sunrise. So they knew. Sorry, the Brinkethley D was the sunrise from behind the mountain, not the sunset. But it's the same latitude. You get the idea. Yeah. And they love to do this. They love to have numbers which are really symbolic, and particularly whole numbers. So that they're all there, you know, from the work of Alexander Thom, the megalithic yard and all this kind of thing. They love to use whole numbers of megalithic yard. They love to use numbers. Even they would make flatten circles and egg shapes to get that whole number. And the whole number thing was a magical thing, I think, to them.
Yeah, because a lot of the stone circles are elliptical rather than round, aren't they?
Well, there's very few completely round ones. A lot of them are flattened or egg shaped. There's type A and type B, flattened type A and type B eggs, and there's even one which we recently replicated at sunrise, which is a pentagonal circle. So if you draw a pentagon, then round off the corners, basically that's the circle, and that is a beautiful. We did that this year for the Venus transit.
Yeah.
You haven't seen that one yet.
I haven't seen that. That's I'd like to have seen that. I'd like to have been part of making that, because, of course, making a pentagon is quite a difficult job.
Yeah, it is. But it is a beautiful geometry, and it represents kind of the dance of Venus. Anyone knows that? Where Venus goes around the sun every 8 years.
Yeah.
And makes this beautiful pentagonal pattern.
That's right. It kisses the Earth. It goes retrograde in five different points, doesn't
that's
it?
Right, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, we recreated that for sunrise, and just before the Venus transit, and yeah, when we've completed that, the transit energy, well, that's amazing there. And we aligned it to, of course, winter solstice 2012 has to be the big day. We'll see what happens. And yeah, so that was a really, really special project to be involved in. And my friend John Martineau, who is a very kind of skilled geometer, and
John Martineau's written under various names a lot of the wooden books on geometry, and he's one of my personal heroes. Definitely seems fantastic, not only theoretician but a great practitioner of the art.
Absolutely, I've done another. We did an earlier circle at another Green Gathering 2004, where we made a flattened egg at the old, up in Cheddar, quite near Cheddar. And that was a really sweet circle.
That's the off-grid. That's the off-grid site now, I think, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. Well, that's really great, Sean. Thank you very much. I know you've got pressing issues to go and see to, although most things have now been nailed to other things and there's speakers speaking. So I'm sorry for catching you off guard with the radio show, mate.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah, yeah. We adapt, don't we?
Yeah, we do. Well, we've got...
Well, thanks for having me, Nick. I've listened to you a number of times, so it's good to be on your show. And
brilliant.
Good luck with it.
Thank you very much. Well, yeah. I will catch up with the podcast eventually. I haven't done any for weeks because of technical problems. That's what I'm blaming it on.
Okay.
But yeah, thanks a lot, Sean. That was great. I'll see you. I'll see you in a bit.
Yep.
Well, there you go. That was Sean talking. Who's basically the moving spirit, if you like, of Avalon Rising on the ground. The man that coordinates it all, really. The best leader we never had, you might say. And he's just handed me his card so I can stick in he's on georepairman.co.uk if you want to look more into what he's doing. I've got Nolan Thacker coming up next, hopefully for 15 or 20 minutes, because he's here talking about complementary energy and vortex and ether science. So he's specifically concentrating on these kind of ionic charges that arise on the leading wings of birds and not on the back end and stuff. I had a very interesting talk with him earlier on about the von Braun character that is known so much from German science and his subsequent removal to America. But I'll put on another tune whilst I go and round Nolan up, and then we'll come back to you and see what happens with that bit. I don't know where Darren Diodi is. I know he's here somewhere, so I shall endeavour to find him as well. But during the meanwhile, here should be a couple more tunes. Here we are back again, and we just finished talking to Sean, who's, as I said, one of the people who arrives first on site. And now I've got with me our other host, the man who has to line up all the computers and the guests and the speakers and everything else and make it all work. And Nolan Thacker, he's been on the show before. Hi, Nolan.
Hello. How are you?
Doing all right, thank you very much. Tom, very much for joining us again. And like I was saying earlier, most of the crew here also do presentations, and you're here talking about alternative energy and ether physics, I gather.
Yeah, been doing some research for a while now, deeply for the last year or so. Kind of started looking at some really quite simple stuff, but the rabbit hole, as normal, gets deeper and deeper, and you start finding more and more kind of interesting information. So I've been trying to piece together kind of viable alternative energy things. We've been kind of experimenting with some simple devices. But it kind of gets you in a territory where you start looking at the present day science, what they're actually teaching you. And a lot of stuff that is going on now is contemporary with us, but is also kind of old as well, probably from Descartes onwards, and I would imagine that his work was resting upon other people that had worked before him. But the whole Renaissance thing really kicked off another look at reality and the manifestations that come with reality. So yeah.
So what are the most significant changes you reckon that we can expect to see in the sort of near future, because we know there's a lot of stuff going on that we haven't seen yet, don't we?
There appears to be a lot of stuff which has kind of been swept under the carpet, if you like. It's the usual thing. Corporate interests basically don't want to move technology forward too quickly because they've obviously got monetary kind of things that they have to look at. They've got infrastructure in place, so they don't want to move on. But a lot of the stuff appears to have been kind of pinned down by kind of 1900, really. A lot of the technology was kind of in place and ready to roll, and it appears that it's kind of been tied up with especially American corporate interests kind of suppressing this stuff. And also kind of the military industrial complex involved with kind of German projects pre-Second World War, which then turned into Nazi projects, and then moving forward after Operation Paperclip, everything still seems to be swept under the carpet. A lot of it's obviously official secrets, military intelligence.
What was Operation Paperclip?
Operation Paperclip was basically after the Second World War, when the Germans had surrendered, The Americans basically bought a load of the scientists that were working on the projects into America under Operation Paperclip, whether they were war criminals or not. So, yeah.
And we were talking earlier on about, I was talking with John Bide earlier about these kind of hidden forces, these hidden energies. He was telling us a little bit about a vortex that he's built, where he could find that there was up, as well as the water falling down, as you'd expect, there was actually energy lifting up through the center of the vortex. And he spoke to us also a bit about the trout and their ability to jump to, not jump, but float, he said, energetically floating up sort of 100 foot. But we also got a little bit onto the fact that it's not just the physical lift that birds' wings get that are lifting them, but there's some kind of electromotive force there. Is that something you know about?
Well, it's a well-known thing within quantum physics, which is obviously a modern-day thing, and the kind of establishment. But they know that the electromagnetic force is 10 to the 40, that's 10 with 40 zeros, stronger than the gravitational force. So if you can harness any type of electrical force, you don't need very much in order to negate gravity. Now, birds, bumblebees, certainly certain projects that the Americans have actually let out, like the B-2 bomber, are all using these electrodynamic effects in order to create lifts. I mean, we know that the bumblebee aerodynamically cannot fly. How's it producing lift? What's it actually doing? So there's a lot of, I mean, I've looked at bees' wings underneath a microscope, and there's some really interesting structure going on there with these hairs that are covering the entire wing. And what exactly are they doing? How are they creating lift? I'm not entirely sure at this point.
These might be similar to John's point about the golf balls and the dimples, because you get these little supporting vortices around the ball as it flies. So that kind of...
They're certainly incredibly regular. They're not spaced randomly. They're within a geometry. So there's certainly something going on there that we don't fully understand at this point. It's interesting. I mean, the B-2 bomber, for instance, we've been told that basically they're using a positive charge on the front of the wing, a negative charge on the front of the wing and a positive charge on the back of the wing, in order to create a wave that the plane's flying on. But from the research I've done, especially a guy called William Lynn did a book called Occult Ether Physics, which I recommend anyone interested in this as a read of. And what he's saying is basically pre-Second World War, at the Los Alamos base in New Mexico, there were experiments being done by Von Braun into what's known as P2, which is potential 2, which means DC and AC, pulse DC in particular, which you put on the front edge of the wing because it creates or negates the... what I would call the ether, the tubules that John's probably spoken about earlier. It eats them, and on the back edge of the wing they use AC, which builds the tubules up and then actually produces a forward momentum.
And so they're actually trying to reduce the pressure at the front edge of the wing and increase drive using these kind of micro forces at the back of the wing?
Well, if you start looking into ether physics, you'll realise that there's several different versions of it. Now, what you've got to understand first of all is that what we're talking about is a very fine particle, and what happens with these very fine particles is that they're moving at incredibly high speeds. We know this from quantum mechanics, that as you move down through finer and finer particles into the quarks and all that, they're moving at higher and higher speeds. So if you've got a particle that's moving at an infinitely small particle that's moving at infinitely fast speeds, it appears to be everywhere at once. So you would kind of say it's static. But what Tesla was finding through his experiments was that this thing can be elastic or solid depending on what you're doing with the potentials and what type of potential you're using. So rather than seeing it as a force or something like that, what you've got to see is this matrix that's essentially everywhere that you can manipulate in order to create a low pressure in the front and a high pressure in the back. I mean, you're not even talking about anti-gravity, because the force of gravity is so weak compared to the electrodynamic force. It's not even worth saying it's anti it. You know, it's just doing something. You're using this finer medium and you're manipulating it in such a way that you can basically move through it. That's what you're doing.
I heard some talk that there's at least some theory that this may be how large stones were moved by our ancient ancestors. What do you reckon to that?
Well, if you look into the work of John Worrell Keeley, it appears that you can do some incredibly interesting stuff with sound. He was using it to disassociate water into finer and finer particles. He found 8 levels essentially that moved from solid into liquid into gas into into plasma, 3 levels of ether, and then this kind of mind level he was talking about. So he was using sound to do that. I think vibration is very important when we start looking at moving physical objects, because we have to understand that they're not solid, they're actually a vibration. We perceive them as solid because we're on the same wavelength and frequency as they are. And therefore, if you can manipulate the structure or you can play the right frequency, then the atomic resonance or the mass of that object is going to be significantly changed. And it's whether the ancients, as we know them, could actually do that. But if you start looking at Baalbek with an, 800-ton blocks in it and several which are well over 700 tons, then you start to realize we can't do it now, and you start to ask questions about how these, savage people could possibly build something like this. And we're not talking about a rudimentary structure, we're talking about something that has stood the test of time. And the Romans built on top of it, and the building that the Romans made was menial compared to the structure that it's built on. And so you have to ask how these people managed to do this. Yeah. It's quite an amazing feat.
I know there was in the earlier years of experimentation into alternative energy devices, a lot of lift was created just by getting things to spin, wasn't it? And Tesla was Tesla one of those ones that managed to get things to spin? Do you think they're still using Tesla technology, or do you think it genuinely is out of vogue?
No, I think Tesla technology is definitely being used. I don't think Tesla was so much interested in spin. There's a lot of experiments with counter-rotating drums with various mercuries and isotopes within them. I think there was there's stuff that you can do with spin, which is certainly well worth investigating. However, I think Tesla, basically, it seems that everything that he produced and certain things were patented, were moving towards this electropropulsion. The Wardenclyffe Tower, he was thinking he had to broadcast the electricity in order to get these ships to move, both on sea and in air. But it appears in later life, after the Wardenclyffe thing fell through, that he discovered ways of basically using small glass spark gaps in order to produce exactly the same effect, because he realized something within all his experiments that you don't need this huge device broadcasting it. It's just not necessary. And we can see that moving forward with the work of Moray, and particularly with E.V. Gray. If you look into Ed Gray doing some amazing stuff in the 70s and 80s in America, where a guy called Tom Valentine was writing particularly amazing articles saying that basically he was going to save the American taxpayer $6 billion a year because they'd never pay for petrol again. He was using this spark gap within a glass tube, essentially, with these. If you look at the circuits, you'll notice that the positive feed into the spark gap doesn't actually feed the motor. It's actually being captured by the event that happens from the spark and whatever is happening there. Now, this could be, I've read some very interesting stuff, which is basically saying that there's some interesting things that happen with the exothermic, endothermic actions in anything under 20 on the periodic table. Hydrogen, for instance, if you pass H2 through a spark gap, it will disassociate into H1. When it does that, it uses about 103 calories per mole. When it goes back from H1 into H2, and this is documented, you can find this in scientific literature, peer-reviewed, it produces 109,000 calories per mole, and we do not understand how it does that. The only explanation is that we're basically moving atoms out of the K state, which is their close orbit that they normally have, out to a larger orbit, and therefore they have a greater volume which is interacting with this ether that I've been talking about. And when it collapses, that interaction releases the energy which it's surrounding in the ether. And I can't think of another explanation. The scientific community have basically tried to cover this up. Back in the 20s, hydrogen welding was the new thing. Basically got replaced by TIG and MIG welding because they said it was better. But hydrogen, atomic hydrogen welding is actually easily capable of welding tungsten. If anyone knows about tungsten, it's got an incredibly high melting point and is very hard to weld. So there's these reactions that we're not really made aware of within the scientific literature, even at degree level. And it appears what Tesla found is that nitrogen and oxygen were doing this. This is one possibility of what he was doing, and yet to verify this, but oxygen and nitrogen also have this type of action when you put them through a spark gap. And therefore, if you contain it within a vial, you can capture, it's reported, 12,000 volts through the event that happens when it changes into a plasma and back again.
And this is something to do with the electromagnetic force that's being applied over the spark gap? It's to do with electromagnetism rather than heat, is it?
There's certainly heat produced, but I mean, heat is just another type of radiation. So it's in the infrared spectrum. It's electromagnetism.
Yeah.
So what appears to be happening is that there's an action between all particles and this fine medium that they're moving through. And that is what's given us these coincidental forces like gravity and mass on this planet. As the physical is moving through, we've got, you know, we talk about forces like inertia, and the thing is of inertia and momentum and what they are. We're taught that inertia is about a body being at rest, but how can a body be at rest on a planet which is revolving at 1,000 miles an hour, going around the sun at some 60,000 miles an hour, and the sun's hurtling, we're following it at some 700,000 miles an hour or something ridiculous. You know, how can you have a body at rest? The spin action has to have an effect on all bodies on this planet. Nothing is isolated. The whole universe is moving and interactive, and therefore what is inertia and what is momentum?
So we're actually beginning to get a new understanding of even the forces and the basic rules that we thought we were working to.
Well, the problem is most of the experiments that get done are looking at things in isolation rather than in their true natural state, which is a bit backward in my opinion, because you have to look at all. It appears that people like Maxwell and Faraday were looking at things holistically. They looked at the whole picture, and it seems that we've lost that. We're trying to isolate things more and more, and perform experiments which isolate things. However, I would say that you can't isolate anything. It's an impossibility.
Yeah. Well, that's very good, though. So we're going to see some changes, aren't we? I mean, it sounds to me like rather like people have realised that there's a bunch of people who can live off sunshine, and that you can run the eternal consumption engine off water. It sounds to me like we might end up quite seriously undercutting our need for energy, as well as hopefully supplying ourselves with new ways of generating it.
Well, I honestly don't know if we need to cut down our consumption, and that might sound really bad because we've got huge problems with pollution on this planet at the moment, but we can have clean technologies. The square inch in front of your nose could be powering pretty much everything that you need. The problem at the moment is that we're being told that we're destroying the planet, and we are. But it's not through CO2 and stuff like that. It's because we're polluting it so much through most of the processes that are going on through burning fossil fuels and the like. And what we've got to do is start looking at what these amazing experimenters like Tesla and Faraday and William Thomson, who's Lord Kelvin, the experiments they were doing pre-1900, And we've got to reintegrate it into our modern world and start putting the technology that they brought forth into practice, because it, I mean, it's still illegal in America to have a spark gap running off a Model T Ford coil, because a Model T Ford coil was designed and sold to them by Tesla, and it is actually a Tesla coil, a very good one.
Right.
And they don't want you using it with a spark gap because of what happens when you start doing it.
So basically, they didn't only sideline Tesla stuff for their own use, but they're actually making it illegal for us to use it on the odd occasion that it did become accidentally available. Fascinating, isn't it? Well, it does seem to me, though, that the whole energy thing is changing so quickly now that sooner or later people are going to start. Do you think people will actually start managing to make plans for usable stuff and distribute it so that the rest of us can gain advantage of it? Or do you think the thumb's going to be kept firmly on that?
I certainly think that the more of us that get out there and start experimenting, get on forums and start getting together, the quicker we're going to get out of this mire that we're in. We've got to ignore corporate interests. We've got to stop waiting for people to do this for us. Anyone that's got a scientific mind should look at this stuff. Anyone that's not got a scientific mind should look at this stuff, because you're probably in a better position. So I don't think we're in a bad position. I think it's all there for us. All we've got to do is start doing some experimenting. That might happen in the garage, first of all. But there's groups of people getting together. I mean, Nick can put my web address, email up if he wants to. I'm certainly starting to get groups of people together and finding more and more links with people that are experimenting with this stuff. Open sourcing your technology is the main thing that I would say. Patent system's absolute bullshit. It's basically a way of straining out the technology and keeping it under military control. So don't worry too much about losing your thoughts, because they're probably not yours anyway. They've probably been done a million times before in the ancient past. And we're just reintegrating the technology that we need to in order to move forward. And, you know, let's not be selfish about this stuff and have too many corporate interests. Let's get it out there. We could be out of the mire in a year if we applied ourselves. No problem at all.
And in the process, we could increase the number of choices we got and reduce the number of demands that are being made on us. In fact, in the long run, it is the way that we're going to have to go, I think. Well, thanks very much for that, Nolan. I look forward to hearing your talk, having seen you rushing around with the drill in hand. I noticed that the crew beers are now out, which is a sure sign that everything is up and running. So here's to you. Good health, good buddy. Cheers. And for the rest of us, that's coming up to the end of the show. I'm going to have to move on a little bit sharpish, because I've got to go and get the other computer out and go and do a talk on calendars, prophecy, and the history of time. I'm not sure how many people will be here tonight. It is a fantastic site. It's now unfortunately dead expensive to get in. I gather that they have early bird tickets that they sell kind of 40-50 quid kind of in advance of the gig, but by the time you get on top of it, it's something like 125 tokens to get in, which is loads. Luckily, like I say, they let me in and give me food and stuff, which is great. Anyway, I'll play a couple of tunes and get in touch with Freeman Jack, who I assume is coming on after the Dr. Rock radio show. Thanks to TNS and the Scottish Sovereigns on the Land. Thanks to Phil, who supplied me with the use of his van and his internet connection and everything. Everything seems to have gone pretty smoothly. And, of course, thanks to John Bide and Noel and Sean and Nolan and all the people that came on board. I haven't been able to get in touch with Darren Diogis. He's obviously wandered off seeking some beer, I think. So I'll try and catch up with him before the end of the fest and have a bit of a chat with him, because I know he's doing some very interesting stuff as well now. Still trying to keep it together with the People's Public Trust, although it's a pretty demanding task that when you're kind of half on the road. But I gather that there's also some tie-up with a private prosecution service, which sounds like an interesting addition. So hopefully I'll get a chance to talk to him. Well, there we go. I'm back by surprise, because Darren Diogi has, in fact, just wandered into the van. So we can have a quick sort of 8 or 10 minutes time with him. Hi, Darren.
Hello, Dr. Rock/Nick. Much love to you. How's it going? Brilliant to be here.
It's going very well. It's all the better for seeing you here, because a few breakdowns down the line, you managed to make it across the field. What are you here to talk to us about? Because I know you've got many subjects.
Well, hey, you know, well, the umpteen million agents of black magic can only stop me so long. What can I say? You know, yeah, the vehicle does cause me problems, but I got here. Yeah, I mean, for those that don't know, I'm now, I daren't use the word residing, so I'm not residing, but I can be found. I can be found in the vicinity of Boddenham Manor on for the near indefinite future at the minute, actually, because there's fun things going on there. For those that have been there before, we've managed to clear out a lot of the problems that are happening. There's some delicate stuff going on, but there will be an autumn programme of events there. And we're going to have Ben Stewart, who made the film Chymatica and also was involved in the film Grip, for those of you that are aware of those films. Ben's going to be coming over to spend a day and or an evening with us on the 13th and 14th of September.
We're coming over to do some ceremonies and some workshops and stuff in a couple of weekends' time too.
Excellent. So there is a programme of things developing up at Boddenham Manor. For those that have maybe been put off before or have been before and didn't like the vibe, it is changing there. That doesn't mean please don't descend on us en masse. We're not quite ready for that yet, but delicate and beautiful things are happening. That's one good thing.
I agree. As you know, I've been mentioning Boddenham a few times on the show. I've been there several times now, and definitely you can feel that things are changing. There's a lot of positive effort going in there. I must admit, actually, Darren, that I think that your arrival as some kind of a mediator has probably helped the thing out.
That's a very, very kind thing to say, and you're not the only one that said it. And I must admit that the dense and rich politics and issues that go on there make me rub my proverbial hands with glee, because I love it.
Well, it is. It's not pretentious, is it? It's genuine, live, proper, what we might call proper politics. It is people trying to work out how to get what they need done without, well, and help, you know, without obstructing other people.
This is it. This is it's proper ground up stuff, bottom up, not top down. And there's been a lot of learning happening during that, because it's quite funny, because a lot of people want to come along to a place once it's nice enough for them to live out their lifestyle and all their self-importance on it, when because they know somebody else is dealing with the toilets and somebody else is dealing with all the crap. But it's like the people who are turning up at Boddenham now, it's like everybody is of the position and the agreement that everybody cleans the bogs, everybody washes dishes, you know. We're all returned, mastered, awakened freemen, you know, independent sovereigns, whatever you want to call yourself, it's fine. Everybody can play that card. We're all bards, we're all poets. You can't just claim that that's the only thing you bring and therefore you can eat everyone's food and not clean anything. You know, that's not it anymore. Brilliant, love it.
One of the things there is that I think that everybody that's there at the moment has definitely found out the things that they're no longer willing to do. And so there are more things they're willing to do to try and enable themselves to you know, stay on the new path, as it were.
Very much so. And the sheer willingness of it. I mean, these are, I've talked about it a lot in the more sort of recent People's Public Trust stuff and things like that, where I've not created as an organisation or given people badges because of artificially shoring them up and artificially, you know, seeming to give or allocate some kind of power or duty or responsibility, and it makes people behave in funny ways. What's happened with this lot is I'm much more about people taking ownership, seeing something that needs done, and they do it. They don't need to be told, they don't need to be reminded, they don't need to brag about it or pontificate about it or go and check in about it, they just do it. And some of the people that are there now are doing it, and it's just beautiful because, you know, they're getting on doing the thing they're interested in, and then we meet and we reflect and we laugh about it, you know, but it means that lots of things are getting done. Yeah. And that is uncontrived community.
That was, of course, something that you emphasised as was becoming necessary for the PPT. As things become successful, you need people who can see stuff. We don't need a leader. If stuff needs to be done, then you know, everybody has to feel a responsibility for it. And let's make no mistake, I mean, Ray Moore's reminded me here about the amount of hard work that's being put in to get rid of the rubbish there. Literally every patch of land has to be fought for, doesn't it?
Exactly. I mean, and literally, some of them are literally landfill patches, but definitely the waves of people that have gone through there, some of them have had to be cleared out, because this is why every other community in this country is struggling or has failed, is because they've not understood how to maintain a healthy boundary. The issues we face in this country are because of a lack of a healthy boundary, where the people who are meant to protect the boundary have failed, and we've got nutters coming in, poisoning the food, poisoning the air, telling our women they're fat and ugly and unattractive unless they buy X, Y, and Z product, poisoning our kids, and that's because of an unhealthy boundary. Whereas what the community, and you know, I use the term very loosely, what the people at Boddenham have learned is, or are learning, is the value of a healthy boundary. And obviously what's had to happen is there has been a bit of a clear out of some people who were there just, you know, upsetting it, you know. And this is one of the problems with the concept of sovereignty, is that people just feel like they can go in and stamp their feet, you know, on everybody else's world because it's their right. And it's like, well, yeah, you can do that, but you really aren't making friends and you're really not building community that way. You know, it's the collaborative and the cooperative that survive, and it's a cooperative and the collaborative that build nice and beautiful things. The bitter and the power over and the fighting lot, the evidence that they showed both at Bodenham and the other places it's been tried, is that they leave the place a dump. They leave it a tip. It's inhumane. You can't bring families there. It's not nice. And don't get me wrong, there's been plenty of work done there. And as you know, there's been work done there, but it's not been able to be sustained because the people have been chased out because of other people's egos. And it's nice that that's kind of, you know, in a way, able to be managed. And it's just an example there. The issues are present in every community. It's just that what we're trying at Bodenham is to tackle it sort of head on.
And what it's fundamentally about, because we've only got a minute or so left, I'll catch up with you again with the voice recorder, don't you worry. But I mean, what it boils down to really is right relationship with each other and right relationship with the land, isn't it?
Exactly. All born on the foundation of respect and mutual equality, because so many people just only understand power over or power under. They don't understand power with. And it's like, we need to get away from that. It's power with all the way. Otherwise, you're not coming from a position of respect.
No, and we are, as we were saying earlier, with the word hierarchy is a spell that's been much abused.
Yeah.
Because people expect a hierarchy to be top down, and the fact it can be from the middle out.
Yep.
Flat hierarchy.
Exactly. And flat hierarchy is how the universe is built. So when we align with that, we've got a chance of actual survival.
Yeah. Very good. Well, that'll do nicely. Thank you, Darren. It was all too brief at the end, but tar for coming by. And like I say, we'll settle down at some point with the voice recorder and catch up on one or two of the other things that I know that are exciting that are going on. But that's brilliant. Put in a word for Bodenham. Do keep your eye out for what's going on up there.